I'm telling you why. Santa Claus is coming to town. Take it, gentlemen.
Hi, I'm David Kenny, inviting you to join me for the annual Everything Old is New Again holiday concert to benefit WBAI. It's Sunday, December 4th at 12:30 p.m. at the Metropolitan Room. Again, that's Sunday, December 4th at 12:30 p.m. at the Metropolitan Room for the Everything Old is New Again holiday concert to benefit WBAI. For more information, visit givetowbai.org.
He knows when you're awake. He knows if you've been bad or good, so be good, for goodness sake.
Oh, no. It's my sweetie's birthday tomorrow, and I forgot to buy a present. It's 3 in the morning. Nothing's open. What am I going to do?
I have an idea. Tickets. I'll buy tickets to a fantastic event. I can do it anytime, even now, 3 in the morning, by going to the WBAI donation website, givetowbai.org. There's a great selection of plays, events, discussions, concerts, movies. I'll definitely find something. All I have to do is click on the header that says tickets. I'm saved! Happy birthday, sweetie! That's givetowbai.org, and click on the header that says tickets.
The WBAI Community Advisory Board is holding open meetings for all to attend on the first and third Sundays at the atrium at 60 Wall Street in New York. So, what's the CAB? Well, we advise management on programming and we volunteer and help out at the station. So please come, bring all your questions and your opinions. And again, that's on the first and third Sundays of the month at the atrium at 60 Wall Street, New York.
New York, New York.
And when they say it's a hell of a town, they mean it's a hell of a town. But it's WBAI in New York, listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. The previous program, Counterspin, was brought to you on recording. And by the way, Lies, my teacher, told me I have to read that book. I really do it. I mean, I could do a whole show on that, just, you know, if nothing else, just covering the American Revolution, geography, and all this. By the way, new factoid, where the deer and the antelope play. I am going to ask this morning's contestant, Matthew Kressel, what kind of antelope we have in the United States or any of the Americas?
I have no idea.
Okay, that's a good answer.
Do we have antelope?
Wow. No.
We don't.
We never have.
Okay. That would be my guess.
We have an animal called the pronghorn, which looks something like an antelope, but is actually related to the giraffe. It is not an antelope. It can't leap. Antelope can leap. Pronghorns were almost extinct, but they were brought back in the 1930s. Thanks to some program FDR brought in or something like that. And they exist, and they are often called antelope. And when you look at them, you say, well, they're sort of antelope-y. They've got horns and everything. That's why they're called pronghorns. But they're a cross between okapi and giraffes. They are their own species. So where the deer and the antelope play, we were taught that in school. Dear little boy of mine, for those who know the... I think it's Tom Paxton wrote that song. I'm shocked they didn't play that in that episode of Counterspin. It's like, what an oversight. At any rate, you know that it's WBAI because I'm just mouthing off at random, which means it's time for Hour of the Wolf.
Thank you.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. With me this morning, editor, writer, all kinds of stuff. Highly respected, nominated Matthew Kressel. You've heard him here before. Stay tuned to hear him again.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. Is there any particular reason that the only time Disney gets close to a reasonable female body image is when they're dealing with Polynesians, African Americans, Chinese, Native Americans? All those women, when they become Disney princesses, have gone through the Mouse House's Unreasonable Expectations diet camp. Yet, in the 2D animated film Lilo and Stitch, the human child of the title, Lilo, a Hawaiian resident, had a teenage sister who admirably had a little meat on the bone, and now with the new computer-animated film Moana, we finally get a Disney princess who doesn't look like the last piece needed to complete a Benetton's Barbie collector's set. Moana, voiced by newcomer Ali'i Carvalho, is, of course, also smart, resourceful, self-aware enough to have doubts about her ability to complete her mission, which is to rescue her small island community from a life-sapping evil by traveling across the sea to return a glowing stone heart to a benevolent island goddess, but ultimately courageous, as befits most latter-day Disney princesses. And thanks to the assured hands of directors Ron Clements and John Musker, who led the Disney revolution with The Little Mermaid and Aladdin, as well as helming the underrated Hercules and Treasure Planet, Moana is a thrilling, funny, and moving adventure. Everything Frozen should have been, but wasn't. Clements and Musker used their first foray into 3D computer animation to create rich, tactile landscapes, and lace their seas with luminous blues and greens. They gleefully mix media, among other things, giving the playful demigod Maui, voiced by Dwayne Johnson, a 2D animated tattoo to serve as Greek chorus, and allowing composer Lin-Manuel Miranda, along with co-composers Mark Mancina and Opedia Fawi, sufficient opportunity to capture the mood with their songs without making it feel as if the narrative has become a slave to the songifying. There are no particularly big surprises to the narrative. It follows the template well established in The Little Mermaid and locked down in Beauty and the Beast, but I found myself moved and entranced in a way I haven't been before, even with those classics. It's not been the best year for animated features. It's not been a great year in general, admittedly, but we do have Kubo and the Two Strings to hold on to, and now Moana, and that rescues things a bit. In other news, you should not confuse the new, very strange French film Evolution with Ivan Reitman's very bad science fiction comedy Evolution of 2001. The older film had David Duchovny giving a giant, cephalopod-like creature and enema, this newer film features a moment when a young boy is bound chin-deep in a water tank while a pair of amphibious humanoid infants nurse at his genetically modified navel. That's one of many disturbing images in a tale about a group of boys being tended to and experimented upon by a group of women on a remote island. Yet the most unsettling aspect of this film may be how director Lucille Hadjihalilovic has her group of children greet the various atrocities inflicted upon them with stoic acceptance, all except for the protagonist, Nicholas, played by Max Brebant, who can't help but question his situation and who's prone to filling a hand-drawn diary with images of things that exist nowhere on the island, things like bicycles and Ferris wheels. There is a certain cephalopodic aspect to the women as well, which may be the only parallel this evolution has to the Reitman one, but the outlook holds closer to a Herzogian notion that to evolve doesn't necessarily mean to attain humanity. And I'm fairly certain that this evolution will not be getting a Saturday morning cartoon spinoff. For Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons.
And thank you, Dan. Always an interesting perspective. I don't always agree with it, but then what critic can you always possibly agree with? Dan does a great job. And thanks. So once again, this is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. These are the few weeks in between fundraising drives. We finished one in the first week of November, and it's going to be almost 2, maybe 3 weeks before we start the next.
This may be the first time I've been on your show in maybe 3 years, 4 years, where there isn't a fun drive going on while I'm on.
Yeah, although I can understand the need for one in December, mm-hmm. And what I'm going to say is horrible and crass, but according to Harlan Ellison, Victor Rousseau once said, "In times of governmental strife and oppression, the arts flourish." It's a great time when people all of a sudden wake up to the reality of, oh my God, we need an alternative that isn't necessarily government-funded. I have to say, I fear for government-funded radio and television. You know who you are. the good people down the dial and on the TV. And they are good people, but they're different. We're listener-sponsored and therefore an independent voice. And if we can somehow survive, people will need us. So for once, when it comes to the fundraising drive, for once I'm going to say, bring it on. The time BAI made its name during the Vietnam War, and once again during Watergate. And then we did okay in the Reagan era. When Democrats, liberals are in office, we sink. It's a horrible thing I'm saying. But there's some truth. And I was going to ask you a question about that later.
Okay.
But before that, we need, it has been like, wait, were you on when the first book came out? Or was
I think I was on last year.
You were on last year. Yeah, you and Raj Khanna both. Because you
not
both
at the
had
same
books.
Time.
No.
I think it was like a week apart or something.
Yeah, you each had books coming out the same time. And
I feel
you
like
each
it was
did
a fun drive.
Readings.
I'm pretty sure it was a fun drive. But, I mean, like you said, I by all means, please donate to the station. I mean, I think it's a great independent voice, and you know, like you said, I think that you know, we need more voices like this, especially now.
Yeah, and
that's the danger when you're in a period where you have when you have a leadership whom you agree with most of the time, you tend to forget. And it's true, because like I used to subscribe to a lot of political, like I'm a liberal, and I subscribe to a lot of political mailing lists. And during the Obama administration, I called and I called and I called, and suddenly I'm like, I'm on like maybe two or three lists when I was on 30.
Yeah.
And, you know, with the previous administration. And so it's, you know, you're right. Like
the soon-to-be previous, yeah.
Right. Well, you sort of, well, I was talking about W.
Like, Like,
so
yes.
I was on a lot more political lists back then.
Sorry. Yes.
So, like, you know, just in terms of, like, you.
Because that's when
I guess you become a lot more politically aware when your party is not in power. Or maybe not aware, but just more. Cautious or more observant,
when there are people in office that you have hope for, mm-hmm. you feel that to an extent,
yeah.
you will be your thoughts will be represented.
Exactly. So there's less anxiety about what they might do, and you're not paying as close attention.
The morning after Election Day. Mm-hmm. I woke up with something that I had as a child, which you probably missed. I woke up with nuclear nightmares.
No, I had those.
You did?
Well, because we, well, for one, like, you know.
Because I'm born in 53, so, you know, starting like 58 through the Cuban Missile Crisis.
We had the, what was it called, duck and cover?
We still did have
duck and cover. We did that. I was one of the last groups to do it. I did in elementary school, and then. You know, we had the movies like The Day After and
yeah, that's 70s.
And what else did we have?
Oh, Threads.
I don't remember that.
Threads was.
But I did.
Threads referring to the things in the sky from nuclear weapons.
Oh, right. Yeah. I mean, I do.
Star Jane Alexander.
One of my most vivid memories of nightmare was looking out my kitchen window when I was a kid, and seeing this big mushroom cloud.
Yeah.
And it felt so real to me, and I'm like, oh my God. And then I woke up.
So you did have that, yeah.
Oh yeah, I had it. And then the other time that was very strong in my memory is we were camping somewhere up the Hudson River, like right on the riverbank, and probably about 5-6 a.m. You know, I'm asleep in the tent and I hear this screech. And I open my eyes and I just see white and I hear this just scream and I'm like, it's a nuclear blast. Like, I don't know what else this could possibly be. And then it slowly dawns on me that I'm in a tent and then it's just the dawn. And what I'm hearing is a train going by and it's the wheels screeching on the tracks. But it was so loud. The train was the thing is, I had no idea the train was there because at night. You didn't even see the tracks across the river, and when it came by screeching, and it was just I just remember that, like,
yeah.
So I mean, yeah, I mean, I definitely
okay. So you have those memories, oh, absolutely. Yeah. Did you have the noon alarms, sirens?
Yes,
we did.
Yes, we did. I grew up on Long Island. They would do that at, noon. They would do the sirens.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I
now, what was that for? I don't remember. Like, I always thought it was just a firehouse doing it or something.
No. Those were nuclear alerts.
But every day at noon?
Every day at noon.
Was it on the weekends, too? I think it was just weekdays. I do remember that, and then they stopped it at some point.
Yeah, they had them right near fire alarms, you know, the little red box that used to pull. And on top of the fire alarms, they had these things that looked like they were out of, out of the Morlocks cave. That they really had that conical.
The horns, the big horn.
Yes.
I remember them and going off. So what, they were just testing?
Yes.
Them?
It was the daily test making.
I remember
sure
the sound. It was like an air raid sound
that worked, and at WBAI, and I worked here as a teenager.
Yeah,
we had Connelrad, which has now been replaced by the emergency broadcast system.
Right. Yeah,
and somebody thought, well, you know, we're always in such trouble with the FBI and the right and all that that. We could get in good, you know, the government won't think so bad of us if we would become the Connelrad station. After all, 99.5 FM, the center of your FM dial.
Mm.
So if there were an emergency, this is a test. This is only a test. Yeah. If there were a real emergency, you would have been informed to go to 99.5 FM or such and such AM, right, where further instructions would be issued. Now, we wouldn't be doing it, of course, God forbid. But I can only... I'm just trying to think of some of the BAI personalities. Steve Post, you know, saying, okay, kiss your ears goodbye or something like that. But if we were, but what would happen is our signal would be taken over by the Conelrad system. Now it's the EBS system. Mm-hmm. It's actually right down there. But we're no longer the station you tune into.
They also now, they do... text messaging, right?
Because
I remember an alert recently, just like that everyone got.
It was I actually signed up for, there are different alerts you can sign up for, including senior alerts.
When they had the guy who left that pressure cooker in Chelsea,
I got
the alert on my phone.
Right outside TechServe almost.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah,
it's true. And the other one that was a little bit further uptown was right near the apartment house of one of the former owners of TechSurf, a former BAI operations director, as a matter of fact.
Mm.
So somehow I'm trying to figure out, why were they trying to blow up TechSurf? But
didn't TechSurf go out of business anyway?
Well, they've changed. They are no longer a consumer business. Mm-hmm. You can no longer go there and get your Mac or repaired or something. Before there were Apple stores, there was TechSurf.
Right.
And they had a lot of problems with that.
So what are they now? They're just recovery?
They're sold.
Right, that's what I thought.
The three owners, who are all BAI people, sold the company. They did very well, thank you. They did a brilliant job, and it's still available for corporate use. So,
would you use that for? You just rental?
I used to be a network engineer for a major New York bank, and let me tell you, if I had that job today, I would be using them.
Oh, I see. I used to do audio for Instituto Cervantes. It's a cultural center.
You know, TechSurf was initially an audio company. But
And like we would occasionally have to do events where we needed audio equipment and video equipment, and we'd rent it. So you're basically
probably
saying
from SIR.
I don't remember the name.
Studio Instrument.
Probably
there.
Sounds
one of the biggest.
Familiar, maybe. Yeah.
Well, now it's you have a problem on your network.
Mm-hmm.
Like, all of a sudden, your Macs aren't printing to the server.
Okay.
Something like that. You have a mixed cloud environment.
Mm-hmm.
Something like that. You're having problem integrating the Macs because they use Ethernet differently than all the other machines. You could hire TechSurf to come in and help design your network or something like that. So they're into corporate design, corporate issuance. You can get contracts and they're on call, but they're no longer a place where you can go get the old BAI Coke machine. I have a thing about that. Frank Heller, if you are listening out in the West where you live, that's your damned Coke machine, man. Anyway, it was a great place.
Yeah.
It was a great place for people. You know, people would come to me for tech support. They go to you for tech support for different things. But when they come to me and they have a Mac, it's like, nope, you can either call my friend Matt or you can go to TechSurf. And are you still Mackey or are you both?
My primary machine is a Mac. But, I mean...
But you're fluent in both.
I am. I dislike Windows 10, like severely dislike it.
Me too. And I'm a PC person.
I tolerated Windows 7. I think that, like, I fell in love with Unix in college, right? So, like, I started with Linux, and I was loading Linux up on floppy disks onto my old IBM machine, which shouldn't have even been able to run Linux, but someone wrote a specific driver for the microchannel architecture. Anyway,
and that's what Xenix was originally about, wasn't
it? Yeah. Was what?
Xenix was Unix for the Intel platform.
And there was also MiniX, which was what was the name of the professor? Like, that's what Linus Torvalds based Linux, not based it off of, but he was inspired by.
Well, yeah, but he
wrote it from scratch, though.
Yeah, there's a whole other story with Fanish fellow who started the whole thing, the open source.
Oh, Richard Stallman.
Thank you.
Yeah,
Richard Stallman.
He was at ReaderCon a couple years ago.
No, he's almost always at ReaderCon.
He was handing out flyers about. I think it was like digital copyright protection or something.
Of course, of course. I can tell you stories about Richard Stallman off the air about how I tried to get him when I was an editor at internet.com, and I wanted him to be a columnist for me.
Right.
And let's just say it wasn't going to happen because I would say, well, you can write about Linux. There's no such thing as Linux. There's only open source. Okay. You can write about open. You know, all I cared about was having his byline on an article, and people would read it. Yeah. That's all I cared about, this commercial operation. Right. I didn't care what he was writing.
I hope you didn't tell him that.
Yes, I ultimately did.
Well, that may be why he didn't end up writing.
No. It was too stringent about it can only be this, can only be that. It can be yours. But then are you going to say that the only proper operating system, et cetera, and that what Linus Torvald did was, it's like, no, we're not going to put anything actionable
right
in there. That's, you know. Yeah, you know, we're not going to get sued.
Yeah.
If you want to tell your history, that you can do. You can share your opinion. But this was the fact. I'll get back to you, Richard. I met him at a ReaderCon. We're at 3 a.m. We're having left a scotch party. And he was just standing in the lobby handing out large delicious grapes. And I
that just sounds bizarre, but anyway.
Have one. And I said, fine, well, what is it? He said, it's a grape. It's the fruit of the vine. I said, I've had plenty of fruit of the vine tonight, thank you. And fruit of the root as well. But and so he started giving me a scientific explanation of what a grape was. I ate it.
That sounds very bizarre, but absolutely something that would happen at ReaderCon.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
So I love the chat.
Okay.
And we're actually on, or rather, I actually have airtime until 5 a.m.
Okay.
But we're not going to do a 3.5-hour show.
Right.
Because that's murder. If we start at midnight, I'd consider going till 5. But starting at 1:30, not so much. I know that sounds weird, but it isn't. But before you read,
okay,
because we are approaching 2 o'clock, and I know you wanted to read starting about then.
Mm-hmm.
Who am you anyway? I know you. How many times have you, with or without other people, been on this program? I haven't counted.
Remember exactly, but I would say that with the Altered Fluid group, it was probably about 6 times.
More.
It was more?
Oh, maybe with Altered.
With Altered Fluid, maybe 6 or 7.
6 or 7 times.
I don't think it would be more than 7. I could look it up.
I can actually go to those air tracks.
And alone, I've been on this maybe 4 or 5.
That sounds right.
Yeah,
because
like,
I was going to say
one time was just like
times.
Spontaneous. I think it was after KGB, the Fantastic
Fiction.
Then you said, I need you to come on. And I found you.
Yeah.
I was... As my friend Scott likes to say, I was well into my cups that night.
Yes.
And I was like, sure, I'll be on. And then, a few hours later when I'm at the studio and the effects are wearing off, that was
we were on Wall Street then.
Yeah. No, this was when you were uptown in...
Harlem.
In Harlem, yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. This is not as good a studio, but a very convenient location.
It is convenient, yeah.
And a nice, I like this building.
It's a nice building.
It really is. All we need are walls. And we have walls, I'm sorry. All we need are walls that go to the ceiling.
You make it sound like we're in a cubicle.
We take a look around.
Basically is, yeah.
Yeah, it is. Mm-hmm. It's. I had a cubicle at Ziff Davis where I worked that had better walls and better soundproofing. I haven't bothered closing the door because, well, aside from the fact that another gentleman by the name of Matt is on the floor. He works the premium fulfillment. Yes, there's actually a conscientious person doing that job, folks.
Yeah.
Besides that, we when we moved in here, we put boxes, Jiffy boxes, all along the top. Then the fire department did an inspection and they went away.
Yeah.
Oh, well. It's expensive to put a studio into this room. We're told it will happen. There's a separate fund to make it happen. But in order for that to happen, this room will be out of commission for like 6 months.
6 months?
Yeah. Because you have to build, you know, the vacuum seal. You have to have, you know, vacuum seal to prevent the sound from getting through. We had that in all of our other locations to be properly soundproofed.
Mm-hmm.
You need that. It's not as expensive as it sounds, but it is as laborious.
Right.
So, anyway, let me just tell people what's going to happen. At 3:30 a.m., because we're going to do a two-hour show, as Hour of the Wolf used to be when it was on during the Hour of the Wolf, the morning dawn, twilight, technically. It's the twilight. Two hours is a nice length. We're going to do that this morning, and then I'm going to play a 90-minute show, a rebroadcast from 2013 with Kim Stanley Robinson, one of my only ever Skype interviews. So I'm going to apologize for Stan's sound quality. Stan is Kim Stanley Robinson. Most people call him Stan. And he is cool. And I should plug myself. And that interview is but one of many available on Chatting Science Fiction, a collection of CDs or downloads available at Audio Sales, produced and starring Moi. So there. Although I'm going to try to figure out a way for BAI to give it away. Give it away. You know, $25. There it is. Amazon, $40. BAI, $25. Make your choice. Aside from all that, and really great people on it, Le Guin. You know what? They didn't take. I offered them my Frank Herbert interview. They didn't take it. I'm shocked. So when people subscribe, I will give them the interviews that didn't make it onto the. That's what the premium will be. I just figured it out. Things that didn't make the cut. Lowlifes, like Frank Herbert and Clifford D. Simak and folk like that. But Matthew Kressel has been, how long since you first appeared on the show? How many years?
Oh.
15?
I don't think it's quite that long.
No?
No.
Okay, when did you start doing Sybil's Garage? What year?
Sybil's Garage, I believe we started in 2003. But I don't think I came on
you came on for issue 2 or 3.
Yeah, so it was probably 2005.
Okay. Okay, so that's 11 or 12 years.
Yeah, wow.
It's over a decade.
Yeah, that's...
It's over a decade.
That's frightening.
It's frightening to you.
Yeah.
I started doing this show in 1973.
Yeah. I don't want to tell you that I wasn't alive yet.
You're an honored guest. Yeah. I'm the one in the street jacket, or should be, at any rate. So for those who haven't heard those, at that point, I don't think you had sold any of your own fiction yet?
I think at that point I may have had like a few, like two or three small sales to some very small presses that probably don't even exist anymore.
And most of the people who were in your writers still existing and still vibrant writers group, Altered Fluid, were for the most part unknown people with names like N.K. Jemisin and...
Yeah, N.K. Jemisin...
E.C. Myers.
Hadn't joined. I believe Eugene had not joined at that point. Lauren McLaughlin was in our group. Right. David Rivera...
who's been selling very well, writing wonderful stuff. Doesn't he have a reading?
Yes, he's reading for... There's an Asimov's reading. I believe it's this coming Wednesday at a Barnes & Noble.
Meaning a week from tonight?
A week from tonight, yes.
Okay, so it's going to be too late for me to announce it. I saw it on Facebook. If anybody wants... This sounds like
a
great
reading. I could
look
it up right now.
Oh, please do. Please mm-hmm. do. Let's promote that. And while you promote that, I will promote the next New York Review of Science Fiction reading will be Monday, December 12th, and will be our annual Married People's reading, because that's what you're supposed to do in December. And our married couple is, as always, and this is like at least 10 years now, Delia Sherman and Ellen Kushner, with special guest host who opts not to be named, although we all know who it is. But... it's always wonderful, and they always do a great show, and that's here. That'll be Monday the 12th at 388 Atlantic Avenue. Admission is free. Donations hawked heavily. The next KGB, I think you don't have to look that up.
It's Sarah Pinsker and Livia Llewellyn.
Yes, yes, yes. I am currently editing an audio version of Our Lady of the Open Road. Mm-hmm. Why I'm editing it, I don't know, because Kate Baker did such a wonderful job for Clark's World magazine, mm-hmm. but we, being Skyboat Media, weren't doing it for, we're doing it for an anthology called The Long List Anthology, stories that didn't make the cut on the Hugo Awards, thanks mm-hmm. to puppies.
Yeah. I have the address of the
Let
meeting.
Me just say, she's great. Sarah is great.
Sarah's fantastic, and so is Livia.
And I don't know Livia.
You don't know Livia?
Maybe I do.
Livia is a fantastic horror writer.
Uh-huh.
And had one of the most memorable readings at KGB ever. It was a...
Then I have it somewhere. Because the ones
yes,
I didn't
do.
Record
it was the one where she was... screaming like at the top of her lungs.
It overmodulated.
Oh, okay.
I'll have to talk to Gordon about that.
Yeah. And I want to tell you about the Asimov's reading.
Just give the date of the next KGB. It's the third Wednesday in December.
It's the third Wednesday in December, which is, because my memory's failing me, it's 2 a.m. Please forgive me. December 21st. It's at 7 p.m.
KGB bar, which is, and the Ukraine Theater.
85 East 4th Street.
85 East 4th.
Yeah, it's a...
Admission is free. Buy a drink.
4th Street and 2nd Avenue. It's like the first floor, or the basement, I should say, is a comedy club. And upstairs...
Well, it's often a theater.
Is it a theater now?
Oh, yeah. It's always been a theater. The Ukraine Theater? They were doing
I'm not talking about when you go in the building, like literally outside in the front. There's a little
Right. That used to be a restaurant.
Yeah. Like it's the Cucina di Pesci
right
next door.
Right. Yeah.
So for those who aren't familiar with it, Fantastic Fiction at KGB, the reading series has been going since the late 90s. I took over co-hosting with Ellen Datlow about 8 years ago.
For Gavin Grant.
And it's always free. There's never a cover charge. And it's on the third Wednesday of every month. And we have great readers all the time. We always try to have one big name and one up-and-comer. And it's really a lot of fun. If you're a writer or an agent, editor, or you're just a fan.
And let me tell you.
If you're just a fan, I mean, it's a great place to come and just like...
Gawk,
and not only that, but just to meet other people who have similar interests.
One of the distinctions I make between the Nursef reading series, which I inherited over years, mm-hmm. and the KGB is that KGB, I think of, Ellen doesn't like this, but I think it works. I think of KGB like a salon.
I think she said, I've heard her say that before.
Oh, she's fine. Okay, she's bought into it?
I say it too.
Everybody there is somebody. Even if you're not somebody, you're somebody because you're there.
You know what?
And it's just a vibrant, wonderful atmosphere.
Who work in the industry and have been doing so for years, so there's a lot of wisdom there. But the other thing that I see there, because I've been doing it for about 8 years now, is you get somebody who comes in, doesn't know a soul, just started writing, maybe not even writing, they're thinking about it and they just want to see what it's all about. And they come 1, 2, 3, 4 times. By like the 4th, 5th time, they've made friends with half the people there. They're sitting at the table with people, they're having a drink. And then they start going to other events. Like, it's like, if you're interested in this stuff, it's really a great way to connect with other, you know, other people.
Yeah, ours is in its way more of a formal presentation, like going to a show, going to a play, where
Nursif?
Yeah.
Or
what do you think?
I think they're similar. I just think that they draw.
I think we only have like a 25% overlap.
Yeah, it draws a different crowd and. I'm not sure how I would describe the difference. Okay, what do you think?
I think that KGB attracts the pros and we attract audience readers. And pros.
I think that we have audience, like I would, like fans, or would you say? Like, how would you describe? Like, I think we have plenty of those.
Pros and smoffs. Smoffs for listeners are secret masters of fandom, which simply means they're people very well known in fandom. For example, I am not a pro. I don't write science fiction. I'm an affiliate member because of this radio show and the Nursif readings and all that. So, but I'm not an actual doer of the work. I'm an enabler.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a bad way to put it. And so there are other people like me in that same kind of position. And there are readers, critics also, people who really know their stuff, mm-hmm. who go there to be in the center.
The Nursif fan base is a very dedicated fan base. I mean, so is the KGB, but like the Nursif, you see... Every month, the same people there. They go. And you see some overlap with KGB, but not the same. I mean, there's a dedicated group there. I remember JJA, John Joseph Adams. We used to say he had his posse because he would have the...
The Baldies. Sorry.
Well...
I work for John. I had, you know, for Lightspeed magazine, I have to disclose, but when we put him on the air here, it's over the radio.
Yeah. I mean,
There's Chris Savasco.
There was Matt London and Jordan Hamlisey. It was Jordan London now. We just had a baby.
She's not bald.
She's not bald.
I was talking
the baby might be, though.
That's true. A new member. No, there were
Christopher. Oh, and Desirina Boscovich, who's also a great
writer.
Yes, fantastic writer. And
Jordan can tap dance.
She can. She once tap danced.
At a KGB.
Was it before Jeff Ryman's thing?
It was during.
Was it during?
It was during the story, the one that took place on Mars with the old stories. Oh, what a wonderful, brilliant, fabulous reading that was.
It was.
And
sometimes...
He's talking about a Busby Berkeley movie on Mars in the middle of the thing.
Well, that's another great thing about the readings is like sometimes you get this spontaneous stuff that happens.
Oh, God.
And you're like, wow, did that really happen?
There was one time when when two other people were scheduled, and before they got up, this one guy gets up and says, hi, yeah, I just happened to be in town, and I can't do his accent, and I thought I would read something that I'm working on. It was Jeff Ryman. It's like, come on now, you know.
Jim... you think
it's
I should,
time.
Yeah.
But just tell people
a
little bit. Okay, you're a novelist.
Yes.
You are Nebula nominated and what else nominated?
World Fantasy Award nominated. So I was twice nominated for a Nebula for my short fiction, and I was once nominated for a World Fantasy Award as an editor. And as a publisher, I published the World Fantasy Award-winning Paper Cities, and also
edited by Hector.
Edited by Caterina Setti.
Caterina, sorry.
And I also used to edit a zine called Sybil's Garage.
A great zine.
Yeah, I miss it.
May it rise again one day.
It may. And
one never knows.
And I'm a novelist. My first novel, King of Shards, came out in October of last year, of 2015. And the sequel, Queen of Static, is coming out sometime in 2017.
Okay.
So I'm going to read chapter 2, which is fairly short. About,
of the new book?
Of the new book, of Queen of Static. So I'm going to... there are mild spoilers in this, but not enough that would ruin the first book for anyone. So if you haven't read the first book...
The question is, how standalone... The first one really has, like... I wouldn't call it a complete resolution. There's openings,
I didn't want to do...
And I only went a third of the way through the new book. I'm sorry.
That's okay. You didn't have a lot of time. I didn't want to do, like, the Dan Simmons Hyperion, where it literally ends right in the middle of a scene, and you're like, what? I wanted readers to feel satisfied.
Thank you.
With the book.
I had an argument with Ellen about that.
The second book, this Queen of Static, I wrote it in such a way that if you hadn't read the first book, or it had been a while and it wasn't fresh in your memory, that you wouldn't be lost, that you didn't need to... Like, I didn't have these long info dumps to say, previously on King of Shards. Like, I wanted, it was all about, like, just keeping the story moving. If I have to, like, if the reader needs to know a little bit of information, I'll throw it in there in a way that doesn't stop the narrative flow. So I think you'll find in this that there's a couple places where, you know, you hear them talking about stuff that happened in the first book, but it's not super spoilery.
So having read the first book will very, very much enhance your appreciation of the second book.
I think so.
And people should read the first book anyway, which is already out.
Yes.
The next book isn't until next year, so get what you can get now while the getting's good.
Yeah.
It's in print, right?
It's in print, yes.
Did it come out in soft?
It was in trade paperback.
It was trade.
And trade paperback, ebook, and Audible.
Okay.
Yeah. So I'm going to read here from chapter 2 of Queen of Static.
And I'm going to apologize while you are reading. Mm-hmm. Please don't mind me. I'm going to leave the room just to take care of some other BAI business.
I see.
And when I come back, do you mind if while you're reading I take like an Instagram or something?
No, by all means.
Okay. So I'll only be gone for a moment.
All right. So everyone can see, you know, what I'm wearing today on the radio.
I hope so.
I'm actually not wearing anything.
I hope so. If you are one of those very, very, very special subscribers to WBAI, you can see what we're thinking.
Yes. You may not want to see it, but you can.
Yeah, these people.
All right. This is chapter 2 of Queen of Static. The demon lay supine on the floor of his cage, naked, emaciated, spent. He would have long reverted to his mongrel form by now, if not for layers of dark magic locking him into his human shape. His white hair had grown long, its tangled braids lying across his bare chest. His toenails and fingernails had grown lengthy and sharp. He couldn't remember when last he had eaten, when he had done anything but swing back and forth in this dreadful cage. The ever-burning bars sent shifting palettes of red and orange across his body, and he let himself become hypnotized by their rhythm until he was elsewhere, his old bedchamber, minutes before the twin suns of Adar and Aura rose above the black cliffs of Abaddon. The burning bars of his cage became the filigreed columns that had lined his private room. The intense heat and ashen
ashen smell were not from the rivers of lava below his cage, but a fire in his hearth throwing waves of warm light onto the walls. The steady creak and groan was not from the mammoth chains from which his cage swung, but the soft moans of his wife as he caressed her. Curse her that even after all she had done, he still lusted for her. "You look like hell." The voice echoed throughout the gargantuan cavern. He blinked and roused himself from the fantasy. The bedchamber still floated before his eyes as he leaned toward the sound. Had he imagined the voice? "How the great Ashmedai has fallen." Across a bleak gap, a narrow ledge connected to adjoining tunnels, and here a young demoness, draped in a brown robe, stood wavering in the heat. A hood hung low over her head, but in the ruddy light her face glowed cinder-like. She had black hair cut short, and eyes on the white side of gray, striking against her dark hair. With great effort, he sat up. He would not allow this stranger to see him so helpless. "Another wretch come to mock me," he said hoarsely. She stared back at him, breathing slowly, taking him in. "Cowards grow bold when their foe is encaged," he said. "Open these bars, and then speak your curses. Will you be so brave when we're on equal footing?" "I've not come to curse you." "Then to what do I owe this unfathomable pleasure?" She scowled. "You don't recognize me." He considered her human form. Not a first one. He would have sensed that. Then who was she? "I see a young wretched thing," he said, "come to gloat over her fallen king. Did you serve in my kingdom? Did I speak ill of you once? Did I scold you or have you whipped? Do you desire to tear my heart from my chest? Get in line." The rocking of his cage made him ever dizzy, and he put his hand on the floor to steady himself. "I came to see what has befallen the great king Ashmedai," she said, "since our queen has imprisoned him." "Look closely," he said. He drew himself toward the burning bars until the skin of his face smoked and sizzled and the air reeked of his burnt flesh. He ignored the pain and stared at her until she let slip a small but perceptible wince. He smiled. The young ones were always so fragile. "What is it?" he said. "Do you not wish to see what the queen has wrought? Take a good look. This is the face you earn when your wife betrays you, when your children turn their backs, when your people believe lies and turn away. You come here day after day to mock and curse me, but I'm no different from you. This face you cringe at, this is your face, reflected. All of you did this to me." "Queen Mashit wishes to bring new life and abundance to Sheol," she said. "But you have abandoned us." He laughed. "What hubris! Your beloved queen nearly destroyed the cosmos. Do you know what would have happened if Daniel and Rana had not returned to Earth to mend the cracks that your queen had left? Earth would have shattered, and the waters of life would have spilled upon the shards, giving us the life we have always been denied." "Yes," he said. "Untold fecundity, for an instant." He smacked the bars of his cage, and they sparked and flared, flashing light onto her face, and she winced again. "The barren shards would have bloomed, a flowering beyond imagination, and all the sentient beings clinging to their dismal lives upon the myriad husks would, for a time, know abundance. Gehinnom had a small taste of this when Earth's universe cracked open. But once Earth was gone, then what? What happens after the waters dry up? The shards would have dried, too, withering away eon after painful eon. Do you think you suffer now on this husk we call Sheol? our pain is but a mustard seed in the canyon of suffering she would have brought on us all. He shook his head. And this is the one whom you call queen. She has brought the four pillars here, she said. They will sustain Sheol as they have sustained Earth. Life will come in time. We will grow. Sheol is a cinder in a long dead fire. You cannot build a new fire with ash. But I almost succeeded in the greatest act since the Creator, cursed be her name, fashioned all the worlds. I would have built a new world, one without suffering, and every creature dwelling there would have been free of pain, able to pursue their dreams as they saw fit. It would have been a paradise. And despite your treachery, I would have invited you all, every last being, to dwell with me. But your queen ruined that. Rana is gone. The greatest architect the cosmos has ever known, vanished like smoke. And Daniel, the pillar Daniel Fisher, wanders the earth. He is no pillar anymore. He has been infected with the Mekulalim curse and become something else. Meanwhile, I, the greatest king demonkind has ever known, the only visionary among you, rot in this cage above this river of fire. Daily you come to mock and curse me. Curse me! Imagine the one who could have saved you all. How deluded you are. How wretched. He spat at her, but it hadn't much force. It arced into the lava below and turned to steam. The demoness clapped. A human gesture, and all the more insulting. Bravo! Is the child done with his tantrum yet? I heard you liked to bluster, but I had forgotten how true the rumors were. You truly are great in one thing, at least. Ashmedai considered her, this demoness bolder than most. Who are you, he said, who comes to pester me? She smirked. It is you who pester yourself, though you are blind to it. I knew you once, ages ago, but it seems you have forgotten. Did we share a bed? The thought repulses me. We have that in common, at least. Were you my servant? How could I serve you when you never asked for my service? Were you in my court, a shield of the king? She shook her head and grimaced. You honestly don't remember? Tell me then, who are you? She turned on her heel, and the tarnished buckles of her boots shimmered in the flickering light. Perhaps one day soon your memories will return. Until then, goodbye, Ashmedai. She said his name like a curse, then vanished into the tunnel, her footfalls fading behind her. Wait, he shouted after her, his voice echoing. I must know, who are you? But there came no reply. Damn you, he screamed. He smacked the bars and they flared again. Then all fell quiet but for the creak of his cage's chains and the lava flowing below. Time passed. He fell into a stupor. He might have slept. After a while, a cadre of legion soldiers came to visit him. The legion, Sheol's army, the greatest army in the cosmos, undefeated in 5 millennia, once were his to command. Now they obeyed the queen. Their leader today was Rethuel, pig-faced, with mottled green and pink skin. Fat white tusks arced upward from his mouth. More soldiers, amalgamations of half-formed animals, hauled a heavy iron ramp toward his cage. When the ramp touched the base, the swinging stopped at once. What relief, though he felt as if he were still swinging. Tusk-faced Rethuel lifted a fat golden key from a chain around his neck, and it glowed as he placed it inside the magic lock. He drew ancient sigils on the iron plate with leviathan blood. The bars ceased their flames, but still glowed red. "Has it been a month already?" Ashmedai said. "It seems only yesterday you came for me." "If only we could play with you every day," Rethuel said as he opened the door. He struck Ashmedai's thigh with his sword hard enough to draw blood. Ashmedai winced, but would not give them the satisfaction of a scream. Rethuel and the others dragged him across the iron ramp. He would have pushed them to their deaths, but unseen magic bonds deprived him of strength. The demons toyed with him, jostling him near the edge, pulling him back a moment before he would have plunged into the fires. Few things could kill a first one more quickly than the ever-seething fires of Sheol. But they were not here to destroy him. They shoved him into the smaller cage, its bars cold and dark. The demons punched, kicked, and stabbed him as he crouched inside. He spat up blood and said, "I know all of your names. Rethuel, Jergo, Umizban, Algas, Thimak, Humisk, Danes." Surprised, they glanced at each other. "Yes, I remember each of you. And when I return to my throne, all of you will die, but not before you suffer an aeon's torment." "After all that you've endured," Rethuel said, "how can you still believe you'll be king again?" "Because I am Abaddon's promise. One day all of you will wake up to this fact." "Maybe," Rethuel said, "but not today, for today is stoning day." Rethuel stuck his blade between the bars and slashed at Ashmedai's hand. Ashmedai grimaced as blood dribbled down his arm. The soldiers laughed as they wheeled his cage through bleak stone corridors, barely wide enough to fit two demons side by side. Torches and hanging lamps threw flickering light onto the walls as they turned through dark passages. Behind sealed doors, in chambers dark and reeking, demons lay imprisoned, forgotten, or dead. A few moans echoed down the long tunnels, but most were as silent as death. He memorized the route as they went, noting every fork, ramp, and turn. Each month they wheeled him a different way to confuse him. But while his body was weak, his memory remained sharp, and he knew in advance when Rethuel and his companions would open the fluted gate. The light of day smacked him in the face as they exited the dungeons. It had been a month since he'd last seen the twin sons, but it felt like a lifetime. He inhaled air that didn't reek of ash and death, but of the briny Lake Holly. And the sky, how glorious were the scarlet skies of Sheol. They wheeled him through a private alley crowded with debris. Broken boxes, animal bones, chamber pots buzzing with flies in the stale air. He'd never have allowed these streets, even this private alley, to become so filthy, but the queen apparently had better concerns. The palace rose beyond the alley wall, a few narrow windows from its menacing facade peering down upon them. But their frames were empty, their residents gone elsewhere for a better view of his torment. They wheeled him past bulls and oxen, mute golems tethered to carts, creatures all sullen as they watched, as if regretting their distance from the coming show. Rethuel and the soldiers wheeled his cage through a narrow postern out of the palace proper and down a ramp onto Suffering's End, a street crowded with spectators. Hanging from a cracked terrace, a quadrupedal skeleton was the first to see. The skeleton, vaguely horse-like, stood on his hind legs when Ashmedai approached, and jabbered in a high-pitched whine, "Here comes the traitor king! Cursed be his ignominy!" Shouts rose from the throng, waves of hate. "Cursed be the traitor king! May he die a thousand deaths!" The buildings of Sheol, ancient and imperious, built of gargantuan blocks of basalt and granite, loomed over Suffering's End, a dark and narrow canyon. Demons hung from crooked windows and slanted balconies, but the street gave the best views. A pus-yellow frog the size of a bull leaped from a high ledge to the street, crushing three demons so she could spit green mucus at him. It splattered in his face. He tried to wipe it away, but it was as sticky as tar. Three hobgoblin children and their fire-haired mother pounded their oversized fists in the air as they shouted, "May he drift in the abyss forever!" A bat the color of dead seas swooped low over his cage and flung a stone that struck him in the head. He toppled against the bars, his head ringing. A thousand demons cursed him as they wheeled him down suffering's end. "How tall they grow," he thought, trying to straighten himself, fighting off waves of nausea. "How loud they curse when their foe sits helpless. I crap on the traitor king. Cursed be his ignominy. May he rot in the abyss." Stones and piss and shit pelted him. He could have covered his face to avoid their blows, but he would not cower to them. They turned onto final despair, where more demons waited, then onto last gasp of desperation to greet yet more, and then onto cessation of agony, each street more crowded than the last. The briny smell of the lake was thick in the air as they emerged onto Abaddon's peace. The plaza overflowed with demons, shoulder to shoulder, wing to wing, claw to claw, all here to catch a glimpse of the traitor king. And it seemed as if every demon in the cosmos had come to mock him. In the center of the plaza, the iron statue of Abaddon, first king of demonkind, loomed over all. Great Abaddon had liked to sit beside the lake and ponder his kingdom, and for this they named this plaza Abaddon's Peace. But it was also because the dead king had promised to bring a lasting peace to demonkind. "Great Abaddon," Ashmedai thought, "you'd weep if you were to see us now. I was so close to fulfilling your promise, and for this they curse me." The plaza bordered the sandy shores of Lake Holly, and the crowd pressed up to its black waters, but dared not wade into it. Even the denizens of Sheol feared the unseen creatures that stirred in its depths. The twin suns shone onto the masses, reflecting off of flesh, leather, metal, fur, and hair, but the lake was as black as night. On the other side of the plaza, the palace rose sharply behind a tangle of buildings, a black, many-fingered talon grasping for the sky. Through a veil of blood and shit, he gazed up at it. A gilded parapet jutted from one spire, and from there he had watched, once a long time ago, 10,000 soldiers march through Abaddon's Peace, as all Sheol had praised his name. "Look at the ugly wretch," they shouted now, "so weak and foul." Memories, like everything in the shards, were short-lived. Objects struck him with numbing regularity. Blood dribbled down his face, over his eyes, but he kept his head up. In the crimson sky, gloom vultures circled the palace, waiting to scavenge the refuse. From the palace's spired heights, walls sloped down in concentric spirals, expanding into innumerable windows and balconies, a thousand lanes and walks, each concealing ancient mysteries. He had lived in the palace for near 5,000 years, and still he had not explored every corridor. The palace teased him, and he vowed, as another stone struck below his eye, that he'd stand there again, powerful and free. His entourage wheeled his cage beneath the statue of Great Abaddon, and the shadow of the dead king fell across his face. Rethuel and his soldiers pushed the crowd back, forming a wide circle as all eyes turned to the palace, to the gilded parapet high above. He struggled to keep himself upright as he wiped the filth from his eyes, and he steeled himself. Rethuel lifted a ram's horn from a chain at his belt and blew one long, sustained blast. Silence spread over the crowd, and even the gloom vultures paused. Queen Mashit pushed aside a crimson curtain and stepped onto the parapet. Though she was far from the crowd, magic threads weaved into the air magnified her image, so she appeared as if she stood right before each of them. She wore a flowing white robe, belted below her breasts with a band of reflective silver. Her black hair, long and wavy, shimmered in the twin suns. A second figure stepped from behind the curtain, a young demoness. She wore a green gown bedecked with angled golden plates. They flashed and winked in the suns. He squinted, trying to identify her, but there was too much blood in his eyes. The queen raised her hand, and if there had been whispers, none dared speak now. "Behold," Mashid said, "before you cowers the disgraced king, who betrayed the shards for his own selfish ends." The city shook with her voice. Her words, lofted by magic, spoke directly into his ears, curling around his mind so that there was no escaping it, as if her thoughts were his own. For a moment he even agreed with her. "Look at him, my children, and glimpse failure. His hubris nearly destroyed us. But I, your queen, am here to serve you. My beloveds, I have grand designs for Sheol and for all the shards. I have brought four pillars here so that you shall know peace. This is the promise of great Abaddon that I will fulfill." She paused and the air grew tense. A brave demon said, "Hail, Queen Mashit!" And 100 others joined him. She raised her hand, and their silence was swift and absolute. "Soon," she said, her voice curling around his ears, "soon you will see the fruits of my labor. You will know why you have chosen me as your queen, why I shall be remembered for all time as the one who repaired the cosmos." At this they were so ebullient, he thought for a moment they might riot. She let them cheer, and he was glad for the respite. He wiped gunk from his eyes, so he might better glimpse the figure in the gold-plated robe next to Mashid. Her face was pale and striking. Like Mashid, her short-cropped black hair shone in the light. Side by side, their faces were nearly identical. And he gasped as he realized the truth. She was the same demoness who had visited his cage this morning. "How am I so daft?" he thought. "Have my senses grown so dull I can no longer recognize the face of my own daughter?" Daphna was her name, and she stared down at him. Mashit turned and vanished behind the curtain as the cheers continued. But Daphna lingered, still staring, her white eyes brimming with life. She appeared before him just as she had before, and he wondered if she could see him just as clearly as he saw her. "Daphna," he said, "my daughter, forgive me." Abruptly, she turned and followed her mother inside, and the crowd let out a collective sigh. The festival over, they had to return to their miserable lives. Ages ago, he had cradled Daphna in his arms in that same lofty room, and there Mashid had remarked, "Her eyes are so like her father's, as bright and white as moons." "But she has her mother's face and skin," he said. "A sign," Mashid said, "that some day our daughter will be great." "No," he said, "my daughter, Daphna, is already great." His heart ached. Ages ago, he and Mashid had sired a new child almost every year, and the laughter of their children had filled the palace halls. Sheol had always been a place of suffering, but for those all too brief decades, he had believed happiness was possible. He swallowed. Were those moments gone forever? No, he would not allow it. Happiness was still possible, for him and for everyone. All other thoughts led to madness. He was staring up at the palace when a stone pelted him in the head. "Cursed be the traitor king!"
You've been listening to Matthew Kressel reading from the forthcoming novel, Queen of Static. This is Bill Jones.
That wear gold in your hair to travel down to Carterhaugh. For young Tamlin is there, them that go by Carterhaugh, but they leave him a pledge, either their mantles of green or else their maidenhead. Janet tied her kirtle green a bit above her knee, and she's gone straight to Carterhaugh as fast as go can she. She doth pull up the double rose, but only two. And then up came young Tamlin, says, "Lady, pull no more." And why you come to Carterhaugh without command from me? "I'll come and go," young Janet said, "and ask no leave or fee." Then of spoke her father dear, and he spoke meek and mild. "Well, alas, Janet," he said, "I think you go with child." "Well, if that be so," Janet said, "myself shall bear the blame. There's not a knight in all your halls shall get the baby's name. Tell to me, Tamlin," she said, "why came you here to dwell? The Queen of Fairies caught me when from my horse I fell. But tonight it is Halloween, and the fairy court is right. Those that would let true love win, but miles cross they must hide. First let pass the horses black, and then let pass the brown. Quickly run to the white steed and pull the rider down." Turn me in your arms to a newt or to a snake. Hold me tight and fear not, I'm the father of your babe. And they'll turn me in your arms into a lion bold. Hold me tight and fear not. She heard up spoke the fairy queen, and an angry queen was she. Woe betide her ill-fed face, an ill death may she die.
Bill Jones with The Tale of Tamlin. I haven't played that one in a while. I love the various versions of Tamlin, none more than the Fairport Convention version. But this is my second favorite, and they're great. And, of course, we've been dealing with demonesses of various forms, although of, you know, cultures that involve Sheol and Abaddon, Abaddon. Sounds more correct. Jim Morrow, who's going to be reading in February, has Abaddon in at least one of the titles.
Yeah, that's
in his Towing Jehovah.
It's made its way around various things. I think it's, I think there's a video game or something uses that.
Yeah. Abaddon, all hope ye who never mind.
Yeah.
But you know that just about works as a standalone. It's really a lovely picture into that universe.
Yeah, I mean,
it's a good choice.
I'm not sure if I said this on your show before, but one of the things that inspired me to write King of Shards was the one of the apocryphal stories of King Solomon.
Okay, just before you get into that, let me just say that this is Hour of the Wolf. Over WBAI New York. My name is Jim Freund. With me, Matthew Kressel. Now, Matt, continue. Sorry.
No problem.
I thought I'd let people know who was talking.
We gotta ground ourselves in where we are, what frequency we're on, things like that. So the story goes that King Solomon I'll get right to the point. He wants to capture Ashmedai, and he fills Ashmedai's well with wine, gets him drunk, and then binds him in chains inscribed with the name of God. So Solomon's servant is bringing Ashmedai back from, you know, the Badlands where he lives toward the temple in progress that Solomon wants to build, and on the way there, Ashmedai sees a groom laying out his shoes for his wedding the next day. Like, he's setting out his clothes. And he weeps. Ashmedai weeps. And then the servant says to Ashmedai, "Why are you weeping?" And Ashmedai says, "Because that man won't live to see the light of dawn." And then I thought, wow, here's a tale about the king of the demons who is weeping for a man.
A mortal
who is not going to experience the joy of his wedding day. And then that to me was like, oh, wow. So this character has moral complexity. Like, one of the things that always kind of bothers me about the...
Epic fantasy.
No, I don't want to say epic fantasy because I think epic fantasy does this pretty well.
Okay, of epic fantasy.
I was going to say, like, a lot of the current superhero films.
Oh, okay.
Is that the...
Which are epic fantasies, but yeah.
Well, yes.
Anyway.
But they, more often than not, paint evil as absolute. And while I do think that there can be absolute evil, I think it's more interesting when it's nuanced in fiction. And I want it, so, like, if you notice the story, like, they're all demons. And, like, Ashmedai, you know, if you follow him through the first book, you're like, boy, he's a pretty despicable character. But when he talks, he kind of makes sense to himself. Like, when you're in his head, he's like, that kind of makes sense. Like, you ever notice there are certain people when you're with and they tell you a story and it sounds completely rational? You're like, oh, I totally get you. I understand that. And then you tell that story to somebody else, and they're like, that's complete BS. Like, how? And then you're like, oh, that's right. Why didn't I consider that in that moment? And it's just that way of
narrowing down that focus. So it's like I wanted you to maybe not, you know,
see the context.
I wanted you to kind of feel bad for him a little bit, mm-hmm. In that moment, and feel like, you know, he once had a family, he had a life, and it was taken away from him, and he's bitter, and now he's suffering greatly, and but he's also not such a great dad. He didn't recognize his own daughter, so mm-hmm. you know, he's complex, right? So
yeah,
I don't know. I had fun writing that.
Yeah, yeah, I can see that, but I love Taken Alone. That's really a lovely gateway.
It's a gateway drug.
It is. Well, it's the gateway. It's a gateway section.
Yeah.
Into that this universe, this right. world building, world mending.
Yes, which is why I picked chapter 2, not chapter 1, because chapter 1 takes place on Earth at a Buddhist monastery. And I thought, oh, okay, it's a good intro to the book, but it doesn't show you the scope of the universe that I'm dealing with.
And presumably in your Buddhist monastery, Tilda Swinton is not the head of the monastery.
No, it's a different person.
I think that she makes a great ancient one. They just shouldn't have set it in Tibet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you want to make that deal so that you can show your movie in China, then move the story to some other universe, some Celtic land, some place north of Scotland,
right.
or something like that. But why set it in Tibet and then say this is the ancient one, but now she's Celtic instead of he's...
I mean, this is what Hollywood does, right? So the Ghost in the Machine, right, with Scarlett Johansson. And...
Yeah, but you see, they could have made... They could have just built a different set. You know, with the casting
right.
of inappropriate types, I don't really have a problem with the idea of casting Tilda Swinton in Doctor Strange as the Ancient One.
Right.
I don't, because the Ancient One has had many lives and bodies mm-hmm. and all that changes, just like the Doctor.
Yeah.
But if you, and I can certainly understand, it's not just Hollywood changing it for the sake of changing it. Hollywood is changing it because the second biggest market for Marvel films
yeah.
is China. China doesn't like world building of positive images set in Tibet and how wonderful the monasteries are.
Right.
The Dalai Lama is considered, you know, not a friend of China.
Yeah.
So they made the Ancient One Celtic and a woman. Well, that's fine. Then set it in a Celtic setting.
Yeah.
But another point about Doctor Strange, you made the... Have you seen it?
I have not, no.
Okay. It's good. It's quite good. And I say this, I'm not the world's biggest Marvel Comics fan, but I'm the only comics that I ever collected were Doctor Strange.
Okay.
That was it. And I the reason for that is that I used to listen to a radio serial on WPAI before I worked here. That is to say, when I was about 11 years old, they had a serial of Doctor Strange, Master of the Mystic Arts. And it was wonderful stuff with Dormammu and the Baron Mordo and stuff. And so I started getting the comic because I was listening to this WBAI radio serial. I wonder if we ever retroactively looked about acquiring the rights. At any rate, the... I have a wonderful story about that later. But so I collected Doctor Strange comics and I read it. I have these comics.
Yeah.
I have the Steve Ditko 1960s comics. I have to do something with them. I'm wedded to my books. I'm not wedded to my comics. And so I figure they're more valuable now than ever they will be.
Probably. Yeah.
So the Baron Mordo is the bad guy in most of the comics. He's played in the movie by Chiwetel Ejiofor. Is that the proper pronunciation of his name?
I'm not sure.
Yeah. He was the operative in Serenity, or Lola in Kinky Boots, or the lead character in 12 Years a Slave.
Yeah, I know the actor. I'm telling the audience. At any rate,
not sure the he plays the Mordo, mm-hmm. the Baron Mordo. He's a good guy.
Yeah.
At the very end of the film, post credits, as Marvel is wont to do, he becomes a bad guy for an extremely nuanced reason. Something that occurs during the... I'm not giving anything away, because if you pick up any comic with Doctor Strange, the bad guy is Mordo. So there it is, gang. Spoilers and all.
Yeah.
If you don't want the spoiler, get in your TARDIS and don't listen to me. But it's not really a spoiler, because you can sense it coming. So I was just going to say that you're absolutely right about, you know, the lack of... you've got Loki. He's a good trick, but he's a trickster god. He's not always bad.
You know, I started losing interest, and I just to preface this, I wasn't a huge comic book reader growing up. I read some, but most of the comics I've read have been handed to me from friends. And you know, I love the Alan Moore Swamp Thing run,
mm-hmm.
and you know,
that was about the same era, or just
I really
a little
enjoyed
after
like
Strange.
Why the Last Man, and I'm reading Saga, you know, I like Preacher. I liked some of it. So I do read this stuff, but I'm not like
you're not big
on the superhero type stuff. I like Watchmen. So like for me, the movies never quite worked, because like, you know, they have a franchise, right?
Absolutely.
So
that's what
you know, you know, like the hero is not going to die. Or, well,
if so, the hero will either A, be resurrected, or B, become somebody else will take the mantle. That does happen and will happen.
Yeah, I don't know. I just it is hard for me sometimes to care about the story. Like I find with these movies, like, they're 2.5 hours. By the 2-hour mark, I'm looking at the time. I'm like, all right, you know, when is this battle scene?
By the way, they
go
faster if you don't watch them in 3D.
On the other hand, and this is a good segue, Arrival was fantastic. Did you see Arrival?
On Sunday, I will be seeing.
Okay,
it.
I mean, you've read the story, right?
I have read The Story of Your Life by Ted Chiang.
The Story of Your Life.
Chiang.
Yeah.
Which is the title story in his amazing collection.
Stories of Your Life.
He's one of the very few short story writers who's been able to make it without writing a novel.
Yes, because his short stories are just, every one of them is pitch perfect. But I just wanted to say that the director of Arrival is Denis Villeneuve. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correct.
I think it's Villeneuve.
Villeneuve.
I'm not sure.
He is the director of the new Blade Runner film.
Yes.
So I was withholding.
And for those who don't know, Matt is a huge Blade Runner fan.
Yes, I am. And I was, when they first announced they were doing a sequel, I was extremely skeptical. And I said, you know, they shouldn't do it, right? Because I would say that very few times when they do a sequel or like try to reboot a series, it just ends up really badly. I mean, look at what happened to the Star Wars prequels.
Well,
and I know that's the extreme worst case. I mean,
yeah.
On the other hand, like the reboot of Battlestar Galactica was fantastic. So, and I don't think they're doing a reboot. I from what I've heard, it's going to be sort of a new interpretation.
Yeah.
But I was skeptical because
there's so much room for interpretation.
Because two things. Because
the source material.
The first film, it doesn't need improvement. It's so
complex and detailed. I didn't think that it needed a follow-up story. But on the other hand, like, the story of replicants, like, we've seen that in so many things. Like, we're seeing it again in Westworld now. We're seeing it in, we saw it in Battlestar Galactica. Like, this idea of ex machina. Like, we see this theme repeating constantly. And I'm not saying it was new when Blade Runner came out, but it was less, people were less familiar with that. So, like, if it's another story about a robot, that wants to, like, is becoming more and more human.
Pinocchio, AI.
Pinocchio, right? Or
it's Pinocchio.
Yeah, it's the
AI,
the Golem story. Right?
Yes.
If we see this again, I don't know. It might be played out. So I'm just hoping they're not going to, like, riff off of it, but not do an interesting new story. Go ahead.
My thoughts are going in two directions. Question number one is, what did you think of the sequels by K.W. Jeter?
I've only read one of them.
Which says something right there.
I enjoyed them, but I felt...
What did he write? Three?
I think three.
Two or three.
Two or three.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it. I felt that it was more of a... Well, it was like a sequel to the movie rather than the book.
Oh, very clearly.
Right. But
that's what he was hired to do.
No, I know, but it was...
sequel to the book is madness.
No, because the book doesn't warrant that.
The book is a totally different,
it's different
animal.
It's different. Actually, in the book, it's very clear that the androids are just cold-hearted, emotionless beasts. Whereas, like, in the film... It's the replicants who are the ones with the humanity, and it's the humans who are the cold, which is a reversal of what the book was about, which I think makes the film better, because it forces you to confront that. I mean,
and then there was the play.
The play that we saw. Yeah.
Yes. One of my favorite episodes of Hour of the Wolf. I should find
Edward
that air check.
Yeah, that was, oh, that's
that
right.
Was that,
yeah,
that was really a great show. That was a great show where there were three people, each one with a very different perspective, where in a way I was like the fan of the book, the word as writ by PKD.
Right.
Edward Einhorn, who had done a very, very good theatrical adaptation of the book, but was mindful of the movie, very much so, and the nuances of the film in his off-Broadway fabulous presentation. And Matt, who is a huge advocate of the Ridley Scott movie.
Yeah,
I should say Ridley Scott / David Peoples.
So, I mean, just to bring it full circle here.
That was a great show.
I was very skeptical about the sequel, but then I saw the director was getting on board, and I was like, all right, well, I want to see his
and he's
films.
A real director.
I haven't seen Sicario yet, but Arrival is a two-hour film. It might be more than two hours.
It's a little more.
I didn't notice the time. In other words, like, I was riveted from start to finish. There was one small scene, maybe 30 seconds, where I was, like, pulled out of the movie. And that's because they decided to do some weird voiceover in the middle just to do some info dumping.
Yes, actually, I haven't seen it. Yeah. But every critic mentions that.
And that was the only time I was like, oh, what's happening? And then as soon as it stopped, it went away. I was like, okay, why was that even in there?
Answer is, it was a story device. It was something that was so Kubrickian in its, you know, we can't fathom this, or if you prefer Tarkovsky, to get even more obscure than Kubrick,
right?
That he opted to just move ahead with a voiceover. That is what I understand.
I would like to see it again, too, because the film is about communication and building bridges. And I have a feeling that the director is riffing off of that in many ways, in ways both like conscious and unconscious, like scene choices and actor. You know what I mean? Like the stuff going on in the background that I was just so riveted I didn't have time to pay attention to all these little details. But no, it was really good. And then, you know, Ryan Gosling in
I don't remember all the actors going to be in the new film, but he's got this like stoic personality, which is very, very similar to the character that Harrison Ford played.
Yeah, which is very unlike the character in the novel.
Right. So I'm like thinking, okay, I could see them doing something with that, but like I don't know if this was just a red herring or something, but Ridley Scott said that he described the first scene of the new film as like there was a guy working on the, like this giant automated like tractor combine in a field, and then he goes into his house in the middle of, it looks like maybe some cornfield in Iowa, and he's got a house, and someone gives him the Voight-Kampff test.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like...
The Voight-Kampff test is the test that determines whether you are a human or a replicant.
Right. And it just seemed like, oh, that's too close to the first film. Like, I don't want to play-by-play, you know? I mean, if they just, like, use that to show how they're going to be different from the first film, I'd be okay with it. If it's just going to be the same thing, and then, you know, the Leon stand-in gets up and mm-hmm. shoots the Blade Runner, and then...
I assume they're going to change that.
I hope so.
I have two opinions about Ridley Scott. The first one has almost always been negative. That I always found something to not love about Alien or Blade Runner or, you know, name his best works, and I'll go off on that. And then he had the temerity to go and do a TV series based on The Man in the High Castle, which most Philip K. Dick fans will say is Dick's best novel. He was sane when he wrote it.
I love that novel.
It's a brilliant novel. Mm-hmm. And so he comes out with a TV series, an episodic TV series of 12 episodes.
I haven't seen it.
About to go into its second season.
Yeah.
So, of course, you can imagine the scowling that I was doing when I was going to watch it. It's wonderful. Okay.
Yeah.
What he does is part of the problem that I had with Blade Runner is being such a fan of the book. I had expectations going into the movie, which one needs to leave at the door.
Absolutely.
And therefore, some of my issues are valid and some of my issues are prejudicial. Okay. In this, I was just ready to, oh, am I going to rip this apart? What he does is he takes the universe that Dick built in The Man in the High Castle,
mm-hmm.
and he tells a totally different story, set perfectly in that universe. There are things that are similar. There are characters that appear in the book that have, you know, larger roles in the series.
Sometimes you have to. It depends. Yeah.
But he created new characters altogether and new dynamics and all kinds of stuff, including a series ender that's like, what?
Yeah.
Some of it is brilliant.
Have you seen The Magicians?
Yes.
What do you think?
I loved it.
So did I.
I loved it. I made sure that I did my interview with Lev Grossman here before I saw the series.
I think it was one of the best series on TV this year. I would say like between that and Mr. Robot are my favorite two.
Yeah, you know, I was not fully able to get into season two of Mr. Robot. I sort of felt like season one had closure.
It did, and according to the writer-director that season two was the actual story he wanted to tell, but season one was sort of like...
I think season one was better, frankly. I know all the spoilers and everything of season two. And I did watch four episodes.
Mm-hmm.
I did get that far. And eventually I will see it all.
Yeah.
But...